This is the United States Eventing Association's official podcast. Hello and welcome to episode 232. And this year, as you will know, we are celebrating our 60th anniversary here at the USEA. And as part of that celebration, we're going to be talking to past presidents of the USEA as they reflect on their time in office and the milestones in the history of the association, as well as their own personal memories of the evolution of the sport in this country. And our first guest will be Denny Emerson, who served from 1982 to 1984, and then from 1991 to 1992. And Denny will be joining me a little bit later on in the program. But first, we're going to be hearing from this weekend's winner of the Jersey Fresh CCI four-star long competition, Felicia Barr, who rode Galloway Sunrise to her first victory at this level. And as you will hear, it truly is a rags-to-riches story. Hi, Felicia. Thank you for joining me and congratulations.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
What a fantastic result. Have you come down to earth yet? I mean, is this just still, you know, you're still thinking about what did I just do this weekend?
Yeah, I did actually come down a little bit. Yesterday, we shipped back into the farm in Pennsylvania, and I got back. I unloaded my mare, put her back out in her field, and then mucked the stalls for the evening. So it was a short-lived victory. Now it's back to real life.
Well, it truly is a kind of rags-to-riches story for her, isn't it? Because it's amazing the way that you found her really when she was a baby and brought her on right up to a four-star level. Did you ever imagine when you first set eyes on her that she had that kind of potential to take you where you wanted to go in the sport?
I mean, that was definitely the hope, but we had no idea. At that point, I was only kind of into eventing. I was doing other disciplines. I actually tried to make her a hunter at first, but if you've seen that horse attack a cross-country course, it's easy to see why she did not cut it in the hunter world. But yeah, it wasn't until, you know, she did her first training level and her first prelim where I was like, okay, I've got a lot in the tank still, you know, to think she could really go much higher. And I've just never had a horse with as much heart as she does. I mean, she's not always the scopiest or the most talented, but I don't think any horse fights harder than she does. I mean, she wants it just as badly as I do.
Yeah, when you've got a good mare, you've got a good mare, as they say.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, she truly is a wonderful fairy tale story for you, Felicia. We have to tell everybody where you found her, because not every time you want a new event horse that you go looking on Craigslist anyway, do you? I mean, where did that idea come from?
Yeah, so I'm from Western New York, and there's just not really a huge market for sport horses up there. And I honestly did not have the budget to go buy something nice and made. My first horse was actually a Kill Pen Rescue, and I took him up through training level. And, you know, we had looked at off the tracks, and my mom just happened to stumble upon her. I don't even think she was looking. She was just on Craigslist and saw this ad for, you know, a young warm blood mare, and her eyes lit up. And, you know, it was through some backyard breeder, and she was just more than they could handle. So, you know, they were selling her cheap to just get rid of her at that point.
So you bought her for the right price then to fit your budget?
Yeah, we bought her for $500. I think it probably cost us more to borrow a friend's trailer and pay to ship her back and forth than it did to actually purchase her.
So when you first saw her then, what was it about her that appealed to you?
I love the way she was built. And like I said, with a budget of, you know, $500, that was the best we had seen for that price. Either, you know, they were broken down off the track or, you know, they had serious training issues. So, you know, we really like the idea of starting from the ground up with a young horse. And I honestly, I loved the fire that she had inside of her. The first time I saw her, they had to corral her into the stall because she wasn't really halter broke. And she kicked me the first time I went into her stall. Most people would have ran and turned the other way, but I don't know. I've always liked the fiery man. You know, like I said, the price was right. And we didn't have a lot of options at that point. So we were really just hoping we could make this work with her.
Well, you found out her breeding, too. She's by duty officer out of Coco Chanel. So you were able to confirm that then, even though she was on Craigslist.
Yeah, so she did come from, it was a breeding farm. It was more of a backyard operation, but, you know, they bred her on property. So we did have her whole background.
So she was 2 years old and you got her home and broke her in. What was she like then as a young filly? Was she still feisty?
Oh, yes. We essentially had to treat her like a Mustang. We put her in the round pen. I tried to create a bond with her by bringing her food every day. And I remember the first time I walked into the round pen with her, she turned and looked at me, ears back, teeth bared, and chased me out of the round pen. And I have never ran so fast in my entire life. I scaled the wall of the round pen and I fell to the other side. And I just looked back like, what on earth did we just get ourselves into? And at that point, I was young, too. I think I was only 13 or 14 years old, so a little over-faced in the beginning. But, you know, we kept plugging away, and here we are now.
And here you are now, winning your first four-star. What was she like coming into this competition? Did you have her at the kind of fitness level that you were hoped for? Where were you spending the winter to get her fit?
Yeah, so unfortunately, I'm unable to go south for the winter. My business is here with my young riders and my adult amateurs, so I stayed up north for the winter, and I was actually swimming her at Maui Meadow Farm, and I've never just swam a horse before, so I didn't really know how that would come into play. You know, I was unable to gallop. The footing wasn't appropriate, so I was swimming and jogging the roads. And she came back this year. As soon as I started galloping, I knew that she was just at peak physical condition. And I mean, she ate up the course this weekend like it was nothing and came back on Sunday morning full of run and jump, ready for show jumping.
And in terms of your flat work then, Alicia, tell us who you train with.
So I've just recently started taking lessons with Pierre St. Jacques. And he's been really incredible helping me understand how to produce the best test from her. She is a horse that carries a lot of tension. And you know, she's just a little tricky to ride on the flat. And he's really helped me further understand how to produce the best possible test and the best possible ride to make her happy and comfortable and soft and supple throughout the whole ride. And, you know, last year we had a couple, you know, a couple really good placings. And I knew once we could put all the pieces together, we could be really competitive. But it's just a matter of, you know, getting all three phases down in one weekend. You know, we've come really close, but then had a rail or two in show jumping, or, you know, she's jumped really well, but had a tough dressage test. But, you know, this weekend really was, you know, a culmination of all of our hard work that we've been putting in over the last few years.
And how does she handle the big event then, you know, with the dressage and then obviously coming into the show jumping ring? Does she have the mental game for this then that you were looking for this weekend when you said everything was coming together?
Yeah, absolutely. She went into the dressage ring and she was just calm as could be. She let me ride her the whole test. And, you know, I really felt like that was the first time I was able to ride every single movement the way I wanted to. You know, I wasn't trying to ride her through something. We were actually able to go out and produce a really nice test. And honestly, the atmosphere has never really bothered her. You know, she would be similarly tense, you know, at a schooling show as she is in a big atmosphere. You know, she doesn't really feed into that like some horses would.
Right. And now what did you think of the cross-country course, though, Felicia, when you walked it? Were you quite confident about how she would tackle it?
Yeah, there were definitely a few questions that I was a little nervous about, but it's a nice feeling leaving the start gate on a horse like that. I mean, she hunts the flags. If you look at the pictures and the videos, you can see her eyes and her ears perk up the second she sees where we're going. I mean, she jumped into the water complexes and took me to the skinnies. I mean, she's just an incredible athlete, and she knows her job and she loves it. The cross country is really where she absolutely lights up.
But it wasn't the best conditions for her or for anybody, really, over the weekend. You had nice cross-country weather, but then how does she deal with the varying conditions?
So she's always just been a very stoic mare. She comes and tries her heart out regardless of conditions. And actually, the event before we came here was Fair Hill, and we ran the advance there. And it was just a total downpour. The footing was slop. It was pouring rain to the point where you couldn't really hear the announcers ring the bell when I came in. And she came and only had one rail there, where most horses were, you know, having stops or taking multiple rails down. So I felt like after that, we could do anything. So, you know, it was cold and rainy yesterday, but nowhere near as bad as it was a few weeks ago. So, I felt pretty good coming into the day, even though it was pretty terrible weather.
Well, she clearly loves her job, Alicia. What would you say now are her strengths and weaknesses that you will focus on and now before as you move forward through the season?
Yeah, so her strength has definitely always been the cross country. I'm able to ride quickly because she does want to jump the fences, so I can take some of the more challenging lines, and I can gallop up to the tables, you know, as opposed to taking a little more time in the corners or, you know, taking an outside line. But our weaknesses definitely fall onto her tension in the dressage, which we're just going to keep picking away at. Obviously, this weekend she showed that she can go down and put in a good test, and we can have that relaxed rhythm. So we're just going to keep picking away at that and hopefully make it some recognized dressage shows and recognized show jumping shows to just keep picking away at those two phases.
Let's just rewind a little bit and look at your background, Felicia. For those who are not familiar with seeing you on the top of the leaderboard, how did your eventing career begin? Was it before the mare, or as it was a young child, did you start eventing?
So I started riding when I was 10, and I started in a 4-H barn. And I think I've done almost every discipline. You know, I've done the hunters, the equitation. I've done open quarter horse classes. You know, I did some barrel racing, some reining. I even did some driving all through the 4-H program. And I did have, like I said, my first horse was a Kill Pen Rescue. And I found an eventing trainer, and, you know, he introduced me to it. And I just fell in love instantly. And I took my first horse up through training level. But, you know, we realized he didn't really have the ability to go further. So that's when we started looking for a new horse and found Sunny. So I kind of did a little bit of everything, but once I found eventing, I knew that's what I wanted to do.
Now, do you come from a horsey background? Are your parents involved with horses?
My mom had a trail horse when she was younger, but other than that, no, I'm the only one in my family that rides. They're all really supportive, but everyone thought I was a little crazy when I dropped out of college to ride horses.
I was going to ask you whether college was the route that you chose to take or not. So you clearly wanted to make a career as a professional rider. How did that actually come about?
So I initially was only going to take a half semester leave of absence. I was going to go down to Aiken and just spend the winter and then come back and finish off school. But once I got down there and I was a working student, I knew that this is the career path I wanted to be on. I was a working student at Full Gallop Farm for the winter, and then I came back north to Pennsylvania and I just never left.
What is it then about eventing that made you fall in love with it when you had tried your hand at so many other disciplines?
I really thought it was just the perfect combination of, you know, the dressage being the precision and the rhythm and the, you know, the relationship with the horse, and the cross country fueled my inner adrenaline junkie, and the show jumping, you know, being accurate. And it's all so challenging. And honestly, the people, I've never met people like this. It's such a family. It's such a community. You know, everyone this weekend was congratulating me, and it's just such a good feeling to have that kind of camaraderie. where in the other disciplines, you know, everyone was just out for themselves, but it's really not that way in eventing. It is truly a family at these big events.
Well, no doubt, whilst you were getting into the sport, you were watching a lot of YouTube videos. Who were your heroes?
So BZ Madden actually was the reason I started jumping in the first place. I saw her at the Syracuse Invitational Sport Horse Cup on Judgment, and I just thought she was the coolest person ever. I remember meeting her afterwards, and she was just so down to earth. So she's the reason I started jumping in the first place. But my first trainer, Joe Backer, was really the one that got me excited about eventing. And I remember, you know, always watching Kentucky Rolex. And I remember the year Mary King won first and second. And I was like, one day I'm going to be there, and I'm going to compete in Kentucky, and I'm going to do that.
Well, no doubt that's clearly front and center now, isn't it? The next big goal for you?
Yeah, this Jersey Fresh was really the last event I needed to qualify for. So, you know, now I'm going to spend the summer really honing in on all three phases to come out this fall and be as competitive as possible, with, you know, the goal being Kentucky in the spring.
So what will you do with the mare now? Presumably she's out in the field enjoying some grass. When she comes back up, what will the plans be with her for the season, for the summer ahead and into that fall season? What will your plans be?
Yeah, so I plan on giving her some time off. You know, this was a big event, so I want to give her some time off. But honestly, she doesn't really enjoy having time off. She goes a little crazy when she doesn't have a job. So I'll give her a week or two off, and then I just want to make it out to some show jumping and dressage shows. I try not to compete her in the hottest months of the year, so we probably won't do anything until August. And the plan is to do the American Eventing Championships at the end of August, and then she'll do Plantation 3-star, well, now 4-star, and Fair Hill 4-star in the fall, all just, you know, with our eyes set on the spring doing Kentucky.
Well, we look forward to following that journey, and clearly it's an exciting time for you, having got this under your belt, a big win, a career highlight, and I'm sure impressing the students around you. Tell us about the students that you have and the other horses that you have in the barn for this year.
Yeah, so right now my farm I'm renting in Pennsylvania, we have 17 horses, and three of them are mine. I have, you know, my upper level mare, Sunny, and two young sale horses. I haven't been able to afford to campaign another horse up through the levels, so I am, you know, starting to look for some help to eventually get another horse going at these levels. But right now, you know, the business is fueled by all of these young riders and adult amateurs that come out every day and ride and just have these big goals, and it's really cool to be a part of their journey as well. Finding it equally as rewarding being a coach to these incredible riders as I am with my own accomplishments.
Well, looking further ahead beyond Kentucky, what are your big goals? What's on your bucket list for this year?
Well, because she is such an incredible cross-country horse, I would love to take her overseas and tackle some of the biggest cross-country in the world. You know, that's really the end goal for me, is to do as much as I can with her while I have her. You know, she's just an incredible horse. I think I could really learn a lot from her. And the idea of going over and tackling badminton and Burley, just that's an incredible thought to me. And I would love to someday get over there.
Well, great goals to have. Clearly, nothing intimidates you about the sport. Do you get any competition nerves on the day?
Usually I do. I always get a little nervous for show jumping. You know, the cross country I always feel pretty confident about, but at the same time, you know, it's nerves as I want to do the best I can for my horse. You know, I didn't lose sleep at night worrying about combinations. I was just more worried about giving her the best possible ride to every single fence. But honestly, this Sunday I woke up in first place. And I didn't feel nervous all day. And I remember even telling my mom, I was like, I'm not sure why I don't feel nervous. You know, I should feel really nervous, but I felt like we had done our homework at home. I knew I had a rail in hand, and I just wanted to come out and give her the best possible ride, and I think I did, and it showed, and it paid off for me.
Perhaps it was your mum that gets nervous.
Oh, she was a mess all weekend, especially with all the articles that came out. I think she was in tears a majority of the weekend.
That's fantastic. Well, I hope the mare doesn't kick you anymore when you walk in the barn.
Yeah, that was a one-time thing. We had a very serious talk after that. She hasn't done it again.
I would imagine, and hopefully she will have the respect for you now because you have a bright career ahead with her. Again, congratulations on a wonderful win, Felicia, and the very best of luck with the mare.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Denny Emerson was president of the USEA from 1982 to 1984 and then came back for another year in office from 1991 to 1992. And as part of our celebration of the 60th anniversary of the association, we're going to be talking to past presidents about what they experienced during their term of office and their memories of the evolution of the sport in this country. Well, Denny, thank you for taking the time to come on the program.
You are welcome.
And we are delighted to have you look back, rewind the clock here a little bit, back to the early 80s when you were first president, 1982 to 1984, and then you came back for 1991 to 1992. So let's start at the first rotation, that first term. What do you first remember when you took over from Neil Ayres in 82?
Well, I think one of the things that people today don't understand or appreciate too much is how tiny the U.S. CTA, that's what it used to be called, the United States Combined Training Association, really was. I joined the U.S. CTA in, 1961 or 1962. It was founded in 1959, and I got number 63. I was the 63rd person to join it, and for years I had that same number, and then they went into some sort of a, you know, computer model, and I don't know what number I am now, but it was pretty much a struggling little organization, I think a lot of the people that, you know, sort of my era back then, Roger Haller, Dennis Glockham, Mike Plum, Mike Page, Lana DuPont, we got involved not necessarily because we knew anything, but because if we didn't, there was nobody else to do it. And I think Roger Haller and I were about the same age. He died a few years ago, but he and I were Area 1 and Area 2 area chairman when we were like 25 or 26 years old. In other words, you know, you sort of had to do what you had to do to keep the thing alive. Neil had, when I first joined, Phil Hoffman was the president, and then Ed Harris, and then Gibby Sims, and then Neil was president for a long time. And he was getting to the point where he wanted to step down. And I can't remember who asked me to do it. I think it was probably Neil. He said, would you take this on? And I didn't have any particular qualifications, I don't think, to do it other than the fact that I was interested and had been area chairman. So I had been on the U.S. CTA board. And Chris, honestly, you know, 82? That's a long time ago, 84. I don't remember specifically how many members there were at the time. I'm guessing 3,000 or 4,000. You know, it was still kind of a struggle just to keep things ticking along. We didn't have a big organization in terms of an office. We were renting. Neil had provided the office space, I think, in his office in Boston, before, and then I think we had we rented a room in the big USET house on Bridge Street in South Hamilton, and you know, we were just kind of going along year by year, trying to keep eventing, you know, in the public eye a little bit. Later it grew, but it's very hard for people today, you know, in 2019, to appreciate what a tiny little organization it used to be.
Do you remember which were the most popular events at that time? Was Ledyard still running?
Well, you know, the big events, yeah, Ledyard, Neil started Ledyard. We didn't have a big event when I first joined in 1962 that I can remember. I mean, not big the way Ledyard and then Chesterland and then Rolex have, you know, came onto the scene later. In fact, I think there were more advanced events in Canada, you know, back in the 60s than there were in the United States. And Neil wanted to create an international event in the United States so that American riders could, you know, actually participate against, you know, the better riders in the world, which were primarily European riders, English specifically in those days. And in 1973, 1975, and 1977, Neil hosted the Ledyard Farm three-day event, and he actually paid to have the horses from from Europe shipped over to the United States. And that was sort of the beginning of the upper-level stuff in this country. And then Neil got sick. He had cancer. And he stopped running the big event there, and Chesterland, which was at Bruce Davidson's farm, sort of took over for a while as the U.S. National three-day championship. And then I can't remember, was it 76 or 77, there was something out at Rolex, out at Kentucky Horse Park, and then the World Championships were there in 78, and then I think the event, the big event, started in 79, and that became the sort of the top of the tower. But, you know, when I joined, it was a lot of, you know, little events, local events. And in those days, we had a lot of what today we think of as mom-and-pop events, you know, like Sis and Albert Gould ran Shepley Hill, and, you know, just different people, couples, usually a husband and wife, would run an event until they got sick of it or got old or ran out of money or ambition, and then somebody else would start another one. It was sort of a hard scrabble deal back in those days.
Where would
compared
Rubner...
probably to England where you grew up.
Yeah, quite. Where would Rubner and Essex have fitted into that cycle, Denny?
Well, Rubner was the big three-day event in the fall. See, in those days, we had long format, and so there were basically, it was a much simpler system in a way than now, a much more basic system. You had a spring three-day event, you know, long format, and then you had a fall three-day event at prelim, intermediate, and advanced. And the spring, God, I can't even remember where the spring one was, but the fall one for prelim and intermediate was always Rubner. And then the fall one, I mean, the fall advanced event was Ledyard or Chesterland. One year they had it at Rubner because Chesterland had folded and Rolex hadn't started. So Rubner put on an advanced division in 76. And then, you know, when Rolex came on the scene, now what, Land Rover, that was how that sort of worked. And the USCTA, the Board of Governors, I was president a couple of times, our job was to try to promote eventing and broaden its base across the United States, because, you know, when I first started, you had eventing in New England, you had some eventing in the South, nothing like today, you had eventing in California, but there were big swatches of the country, you know, where, you know, you might have two or three or four horse trials in the whole area. It was a sort of a pull yourself up by your own bootstraps sort of deal back then.
And in terms of the rules then, the infancy of the organization, Denny, do you remember what those pivotal changes might have been during your terms?
Well, I can't remember specifically, but I remember some of the pivotal changes was when I started, the first year I rode in any event, well, I rode in a little schooling thing at Hitching Post in 1961, which is my first event. And but in 62, I rode at GMHA, and I went prelim, and that's all you had. You had prelim, intermediate, and advanced. You didn't have training. You didn't have novice. You didn't have beginner novice, and you didn't have starter. And so you had to start up. You had to start at, you know, 3-6, theoretically. And but a prelim course in 1962 or, you know, 82 still was not as technically difficult or as big probably as its equivalent in 2019. And so you started at a higher level, and that presumed that you had done something before you started eventing. You had either fox hunted or done horse shows or jumper shows or something. But you know, 82, 92, 02, 12, we're talking what, 30, almost 40 years ago when I was first president. I can't remember specifically who did what or what was around in those days, specifically looking, mm-hmm. looking back.
Yeah, it's a long way back, isn't it? But do you remember the horses that, obviously the horses that you were riding and those that were, you know, at the highest level of the sport competing against you then, Denny?
Well, I remember, you know, certainly I remember I was on the, I went over to Europe in 74, which is 45 years ago now. And, you know, it was the same, it was Mike Plum. Mike Plum and Bruce Davidson were always sort of the core of the team. And then, good, you could put anybody, you could put a monkey on with them and would still win a gold medal because they were the two best riders in the world. So around Mike and Bruce, you had Jimmy Wofford, Torrance Watkins, Ted Coffin, Marianne Toski, you know, and sort of those riders. And, you know, Don Saatchi, we were good riders. But, you know, Mike and Bruce anchored the team.
Yeah, it was an interesting period in the evolution of the sport, wasn't it? Were there any other standout moments for you when you were president then, Denny? And in terms of, can you also remember the executive committee that served with you as well, the board members?
I can remember specifically something. We used to have some of our meetings in General Burton's house, which was on, Walnut Avenue or something, right across the road from Ledyard. And Jack Fritz, Neil Ayre, Jack Burton, Roger Haller, myself, I'm probably forgetting some very key people, but the question used to come up, you know, what is it we're trying to do here? What are we trying to create? And I can remember something General Burton said. He said, we are trying to create a sport that is fun, fair, and affordable. And he said, fair means you have to have rules. Fun means it should be accessible. And not too overly burdened by rules and regulations. And, you know, he said, otherwise people won't get involved. And he said the big key is not to get it too expensive. And I can remember a conversation I had with Jack when he was 92, which would have been, what, 7 years ago. And Jack said, you know what? remember what I told you guys about making it fun, fair, and affordable? He said, I think we're beginning to price ourselves out of the market. He said that everything is so expensive now, and you have to go, and you have to have, you know, to compete in an event now, you have to have AHS or USEF rules, and you have USEA rules, and you have drug fees, and you have trailer in fees, and you have stalls fees, and you have, and he said, you know, we're maybe making this a little bit, you know, inaccessible to people, where our objective was to make it accessible. So I think that was, that's maybe a little switch that we've seen in the sport. You know, it's hard to pay all those fees. And that's why I think we're seeing such a big divide now between people who join up in all these organizations and go through all the hassle and people who don't, who just go to schooling trials. You know, horse doesn't know the difference whether it's an official event or a schooling trial.
Right. Are there any other moments that you reflect on with fond memory, Denny, of those early days and whilst you were in the position of president and how you could influence change to the sport?
Well, I remember, you know, there's always been the worry about safety. You know, even back then, you know, it wasn't all dandelions and roses, right? It, you know, people, there were horse falls and there were horses getting injured. And I don't remember people getting killed, but, you know, there was always a safety issue. And I can remember one of the things that I did when I was president, I talked, there was a guy named Bill McCollum, his wife Karen McCollum was an advanced level rider, and he, Bill, was big into U.S. skiing. He had been captain of the Middlebury ski team, and he was still very deeply involved. And I had read somewhere that skiing had gone through a similar safety issue. And I, so I called Bill and I said, so what have you guys done? What does skiing do to, and he said, you know, it's interesting. He said, we used to have a lot of trouble, bad falls, bad wrecks. And he said, the FIS, which is like our, what would it be? FEI,
yes.
Federation of Skiing, instituted something called the captain's meeting or the captain's something or other. And he said, before every major race or any race, I guess if it's high school or college or professional race, the captains of the different college or high school teams or whatever, they go down the course early in the morning of the race, and then they meet with the officials, and they say, you know what, between gate 5 and 6 is a really icy patch. You need to change the line there. And you need to maybe put some new straw bales on the side here where you could easily run off the course and blah, blah, blah. I don't know what it, you know, I'm not a skier. But he said, since we did that, and he said, the key thing is the officials have to listen to you. They have to not just blow you off and say, hey, man up, you know. And so we started something called the rider rep thing. And theoretically, in the morning, you know, if you, every event was supposed to have a rider rep at the, from prelim, intermediate, and advanced, and they were supposed to, and the riders could walk the course, and then they were supposed to go to the rider rep and say, I don't like the footing in front of fence 8, or you need a row of straw bales in front of fence 12 because it's a kind of a false ground line, or you can't see over the top of it, and you're going to have a rotational fall, or blah, blah, blah. And then that, then those people were supposed to go back to the technical delegate and the ground jury and report, and the ground jury was supposed to listen to them. And for a while that worked. And then I don't know if it's still working or not. I don't even know if it still exists. But I do remember that was something that I helped institute on Bill McCollum's advice, which seems like a smart thing to do. So that's one thing I remember.
Wonderful. Well, interesting times. And then, as I said, you came back for 91 to 92, just for a year. there after Walter Strauss and before Mike Huber.
Yeah, I guess they didn't have somebody at that point. I think they were grooming Mike Huber to do it or something, and they just asked me if I would come back in for a little stopgap year.
And you would have noticed a difference then, right? Because from 1982 to the second term, which ended in 1992, there's a 10-year difference.
I think we were a bigger, stronger organization by then. I think the biggest problem was, you know, I talked to him. You know, Bill. Remember Bill Steinkraus?
Of course.
I don't know if you ever met.
I did, indeed.
But Bill, yeah, Bill and I were sitting at a USCT meeting in Gladstone one time. And he was in a chatty mood, and he said, you know, he said, it's interesting eventing. He said, I've never been an event rider, but he said, I've watched it pretty closely at the Olympic level since 1952 or 56 or something like that. And he said, I've seen eventing go through three different incarnation, so to speak. He said, when I first saw it, it was all military guys. And he said, they were officers and, you know, officer and a gentleman. You know, they were officers in uniform. And, you know, basically, the military would come up with the team for England, France, Germany, America, whatever. He said, that lasted until after the Second World War, 1948, all the basic cavalries were disbanded all over the world, at least in the United States it was, some earlier, some later. And he said, so then probably the sport would have died. And he said, but what rescued it was a fox hunting community. And it started with in England with the Duke of Beaufort in 1949 starting badminton, and he was a master of foxhounds. And he said when the USCTA was founded, it was Phil Hoffman, who was, I don't know if he's a master of Essex hunt, but he hunted with Essex. And then Ed Harris was I don't know if he was a master of foxhounds, but he hunted out at Geneseo. And Gibby Semmes was a fox hunting guy. Neil Ayer was a master of myopia. And he said, so the fox hunting community basically rescued eventing from oblivion after World War II, when it probably would have just vanished as a sport. And he said they were interested in the big galloping horses. You know, that's sort of that was the heyday of the long format, you know, the badminton burly. They were like 15, 18 miles long, you know, and it was mostly thoroughbred galloping horses. And he said then, so that was so military, and then fox hunting, and then he said what happened was it became more of a specialist game. And he said what happened was you had these good riders, and they kind of figured out how to do it. So then the course designers figured, okay, we got to make it a little more technically difficult. So they would come up with new things, and then the riders would master those, and then the course designers would come up with new things. And so he said now you have, at the upper levels, you have something that the average horse wouldn't just do, or the average fox hunter wouldn't do, because they have to jump corners and skinnies and angles and bounces and, you know, whatever. And I think now, then the huge change came when it went from long format to short format. Now it's incredibly technical and specific, you know, skinny to skinny brush to toothbrush at an angle. And you know, so the sport has changed dramatically, you know, from when I got involved in it, 62, what was that, 57 years ago.
Yeah, that's a long memory, Denny, and we really appreciate you reflecting on some of those times that I think, you know, will be lost in history unless we have these kind of conversations. So thank you very much for taking the time to come on the program and go back down memory lane.
Okay, thanks a lot, Chris.
And next month, I'll be chatting to Mike Huber, who succeeded Denny when he took over the presidency from 1993 to 1995. And I'll be back in 2 weeks' time for another episode of the USCA's official podcast. In the meanwhile, be sure to follow us on social media to keep up with the latest postings and all the latest news at the USCA. If you're listening to this podcast online, you can also subscribe free on any podcast app so you don't miss an episode. Until the next time, thank you for listening wherever you are in the world, and enjoy your eventing.